Good morning, everyone. NBC reporters are standing by in the capitals of the two principal warring nations overseas. The points from which their war efforts are directed and are ready with the latest news. We'll hear first this morning from the British capital. Go ahead, London.
This is John McVane in London. British bombers last night attacked Dunkirk, Boulogne, Calais, and Ostend. The Air Ministry communique says that although weather over northwestern Europe was generally unfavorable, visibility over the channel was good, and the attacks were on a large scale. The attack on Boulogne was spread over 3 hours, and large fires were started at supply stores and other dockside buildings. All the aircraft returned safely to their bases. No attacks were made on Britain during the night. An official report reaching London from Cairo today gives details of how the British mechanized forces, with a single tactical maneuver, outflanked and cut off the Italian army that held Benghazi. To find a parallel exploit in British military history, you'd have to go a long way back, perhaps back to the Napoleonic Wars. A British armored formation, beating down resistance as it crashed across country, made a forced march of 150 miles in 30 hours. It cut across the Italians' last line of retreat, and the Benghazi garrison found itself bottled up. With heavier forces than the British, the Italians flung their tanks, supported by infantry and artillery, against the British line. Each attempt was thrown back with heavy losses, and after the British had destroyed 60 Italian tanks, the Italians surrendered. Large numbers of Italian prisoners were captured. The generals who surrendered included an army commander and a corps commander. Military circles in London today called the taking of Benghazi the final blow in the demoralization of the Italian army in Cyrenaica. They indicated that future operations in the area will consist of mopping up and consolidating the administration of the country. A series of minor cabinet changes was announced this morning. The changes follow the death of Lord Lloyd, the colonial secretary. His post is filled by Lord Moyne. Mr. Malcolm MacDonald, the former Minister for Health, is selected to fill the post of British High Commissioner to Canada. The new Minister for Health is Mr. Ernest Brown. The report that Mr. Harry Hopkins had left England was denied by American embassy circles in London today. Mr. Hopkins is still in England, and so far as is known, has not yet decided when he will leave. Whether he will give a press interview before he starts for America depends, it's understood, on whether he has anything to say and time to say it in. In the only press interview he's given here, Mr. Hopkins was extremely friendly and pleasant, but as silent as a clam on anything that had to do with his visit to England. But he's seen about all there is to see around here, and he's been given off-the-record facts by British statesmen who talked to him in much the same way they'd talked to the man he represents, Mr. Roosevelt. One paper today says that Mr. Hopkins has rapidly established his position in Britain and points out that he has built a firm unity of counsel between Mr. Churchill and Mr. Roosevelt, and indeed between the two governments. To observers here, it seems as though American diplomacy is exerting a greater influence in world affairs than perhaps at any other time in history. At the end of the last war, just before President Wilson came to Europe, America may have had as great a potential power in influencing the future of the world, but that potential was never realized. Now, with most of Europe at war, America's influence over here has reached its zenith. In the Balkan nations that have not yet been conquered by Germany, in the countries that Germany has already overrun, in the Near and Far East, the realization is growing that America holds the same balance of power in the world that England traditionally held in the continent of Europe. The chief fact emerging from the diplomatic panorama of Europe seems to be that the side America chooses in this world struggle will be at long last the winning side. It's only by keeping this in mind that you can realize why Russia hasn't given Germany more cooperation, why the small Balkan nations haven't thrown themselves into Germany's hands, and why the spark of hope still flames high in the Czechs and the Poles. The presence of Admiral Leahy in Vichy is probably one very good reason for Marshal Petain's unwillingness to give in to Hitler's demands. Colonel Wild Bill Donovan's travels in the Near East, from all reports, have strengthened the belief in the nations he's visited that when the shooting's all over, their future will be in the hands of America and Britain, not the Axis. And there are few people in England who don't think that the power of the American Navy and the plain talking of American diplomats has had something to do with keeping Japan from jumping into the war on the side of the Axis. In spite of all the bluster from the Wilhelmstrasse about the decadent democracies, there must be a good many of the Nazi leaders who realize that if America ever should go to war, that day would mean the end of all hope for a German Europe. At least the chief propaganda theme aimed at Britain by the Germans these days is the theme that America can't and won't help Britain. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And now from the Associated Press, we have a bulletin from Rome. Italian troops withdrew from Benghazi Thursday night to spare civilian population after extremely bitter fighting in which the Italian and British losses were high. The Italian High Command announced that today. And now news from the capital of Germany. We call in another of our war reporters, so go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Theodor Knaut speaking from Berlin. There is no mention in the papers here this morning of the fall of Benghazi yesterday, and beyond the fact that a battle was underway there, reported in yesterday's Italian communique, the subject has not been touched on in any way. The Essener Nationalzeitung, which is Reichsmarschall Göring's paper, dealing with the battle in northern Africa under the heading Churchill's Latest Bluff, says that the British armored cars, some of which are said to have been built in America, were able to smash Italian pillboxes with their artillery, although they were made of concrete 3 feet thick. And the paper, quoting Italian newspapers, also asserts that President Roosevelt's speeches are written for him by a Jew, Samuel Roseman, to which it adds no comment. German long-range bombing planes, ranging far out into the Atlantic west of Ireland in spite of bad weather conditions, report that on this ordinarily busy sea route they were unable to see a single enemy merchantman for them to attack and sink. The British Air Forces, we are told here, with the same bad weather to contend with, made only solitary flights into German-occupied territory yesterday, and they lost a bomber that was shot down while another was forced to the ground and its crew of six taken prisoner. Current reports are that the British airplane carrier Illustrious, which was damaged in battle and while tied to her dock in Malta, where she was believed to have sunk to the bottom of the harbor, has made her way to Alexandria after all. A single German bomb hit on the Illustrious, it is admitted by the British, killed 80 men and damaged 20 planes, it is said here. No further light is thrown on the Vichy situation here today, but it is learned that Admiral Darlan, the go-between in intercourse between the two parts of France, was in Paris again yesterday, where he conferred with Pierre Laval and the German ambassador, Otto Abetz. A decision may be expected soon, perhaps today even, and the government here is fully apprised of the demands made by both sides, though it takes no stand officially either way. Vichy has denied, it is said here, that the British sent an ultimatum to French troops in Syria to take no further part in the war. Nothing is known here either of a reported coming meeting between Serrano Sr. of Spain, Hitler, and Mussolini, nor of a possible visit by Senor Sunya to Vichy. With regard to the recent German-Russian trade treaty, statements made here are to the effect that it continues the old arrangement but on a wider scale. Since German deliveries of machinery take a longer time than what Russia sends in the way of raw materials, the German delivery terms are considerably longer than the Russian, so that Germany is in Russia's debt until both quotas are completed, when, of course, they will balance each other. Deliveries both ways are being figured in marks, it is stated here. Arrangements have also been made to clear payments between the occupied and the unoccupied parts of France that have become due since the armistice through the existing German clearing bank in Berlin and the Office de Compensation in Paris. Winter sports meetings now being held in Cortina are being considered here as international championships, and the winners are hailed as world champions in their respective events. The Germans have won six of these to date, but the feature of the meeting was the defeat of the German girl ace, Crystal Krantz, in skiing by a young Italian girl who was competing for the first time. The Italian communique, which has just appeared, admits the evacuation of Benghazi after a very severe 2 days battle, which caused great losses to both sides. This is Theodore Knaut speaking from Berlin and returning you to NBC.
You've just heard the latest news direct from England and Germany as reported by NBC correspondents stationed in London and Berlin. For news from our own capital, we take you now to our NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, this is Earl Godwin speaking. Wendell Willkie is expected to land at Trinidad right now. We may get the news of his landing during the course of this 5 minutes. Mr. Willkie is expected to tell the Senate Foreign Relations Committee what he's learned in England and London and Ireland, this being the advance agent's prediction for the big show on Capitol Hill for Monday or Tuesday of next week. Meantime, John G. Wynant, newly nominated ambassador to Great Britain, has been okayed by that same committee and will undoubtedly be confirmed by the Senate next week, ready to leave for his new post in about 3 weeks. It is now apparent that the choice of Mr. Wynant for ambassador has to do with President Roosevelt's belief in the shape of things to come. The new and liberal moves in England among the general mass of people interest Mr. Roosevelt. He therefore sends to England a liberal-minded Republican, interested and experienced in mass movements for betterment of welfare and labor conditions. He sends a man who can talk the same language as English labor leader Bevin, who's pulling so long a stroke on British affairs today. Perhaps, and there's talk of it here, the president withheld his nomination of Mr. Wynant until he had sent Harry Hopkins over to scout around and scout ahead and advise Washington by telephone. The Wynant appointment, therefore, seems to be a very important break in the line of career diplomatic appointments which have heretofore been almost always the rule. And all of this relates back to the things you heard from our London broadcast 5 minutes ago. Another important variation from the routine career diplomatic appointment has been that of the salty sea dog now in Vichy for the United States. And I refer, of course, to Admiral Leahy, who seems to have been picked because of his native quality of putting a stiffer backbone into weak sisters wherever they appear. Now, the House of Representatives will probably finish the lease-lend bill this afternoon. One important unfinished item has to do with a possible limit on the total expense, the total money to be expended in this arsenal for the democracies. The limitation written into that bill last night, according to headlines and news stories, was really more than a limitation. It was a shortcut to immediate use of 10% of material, defense material, Army and Navy material already on hand or on order. And this should not be confused with a total and final limitation. What they did in the House last night was to write in permission to the president to use 10% of last year's defense bill, which is $1.3 billion, 10% is. The whole defense program cost $13 billion last year. 10% of it would be $1.3 billion worth of national defense stuff to be used now if need be without any further okaying or authorization, and the president to come back and get further authority when he needs more or they need more. Well, I've already told you that the Dyes Committee charges that the Germans are putting huge sums of money to the credit of Russia in certain New York banks and vice versa. Something odd and interesting is going on there if the Dyes Committee is correct. Now the executive branch of the government takes it up. The Treasury Department is setting up a special unit to keep track of what the totalitarian powers are doing with their money in the United States. And there's a great amount of national interest in the government's antitrust suit against the American Medical Association here, the association charged with boycotting and otherwise stifling the efforts of cooperative medical groups here known as Group Health Incorporated. Dr. Hugh Cabot, well-known Bostonian, told the jury here yesterday that some such plan as Group Health is now necessary for the average American family, which, he said, could not now afford the average medical man's charges. And Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's the news from the nation's capital at this time.
We have concluded another roundup of world capitals. NBC reporters in London, Berlin, and Washington have covered the latest developments in the international situation. This is the National Broadcasting Company.